Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. This episode of the Folklore Podcast Book Club is an audio version of an episode originally made for YouTube. To see the original with any pictorial references, please visit www.youtube.com/folklorepodcast and click on the book club playlist.
Hello and welcome to the Folklore Podcast Book Club, YouTube-based programming from the Folklore Podcast, which looks at books, authors and publishers whose work intersect with the field of folklore. In today's episode, I'm joined by author Tom Phillips, who talks about his book, Forest Folk Tales for Children.
Welcome, Tom, to the Folklore Podcast Book Club. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. So we are going to talk today about your folklore book for children, which we can both wave at the camera now. Forest Folk Tales for Children, which is published by the History Press. And I'm going to hazard a guess that because you are an ex-primary school teacher, you chose to go with the children's folklore book rather than going in a different direction. So in order to see whether I'm right or wrong in this fact, I'm going to ask you to just tell us a little bit about yourself and that background that you have and how you have now moved from that into storytelling.
Yes, so I grew up in a house full of kids. My mum was a childminder and my dad worked at the local primary. And then when I turned 18, my first full-time job was a teaching assistant in a primary school. And it just kind of stumbled on from there. I worked in outdoor ed quite a bit. I spent some time in Wales, various places. And then I did my teacher qualification when I was a bit older, mature student. I wouldn't have classed myself as a mature student. It took me 5 years to complete a three-year course because I had a two-year break. Teaching, although I loved the whole working with children thing, I knew I was good with a class of children. It was all the extra bits around it that I struggled with. And so I thought at the end of the day, let's get a degree. That'll help me go forward. I became a teacher. And growing up, I always liked stories. I remember my dad reading the Enid Blyton Brer Rabbit stories to me. I always liked storytelling. I loved the Jim Henson Storyteller program that was on back in the late 80s. And as a teacher, I started to tell some of these stories on a Friday afternoon to my class. The last 10 minutes or so, I know I'll tell you a story. And I'd leave them on a cliffhanger and then you'd have to wait another week. And I really enjoyed it and started looking into it and realised it's not just for kids that you can do it, storytelling to adults. And so I went along to Nottingham, to the old trip to Jerusalem, where Pete Davis, who's no longer with us, he ran a storytelling club. And I had my first go at telling stories to adults. The 10-minute story went on for 20 minutes. I nearly broke an invaluable fertility chair by jumping on it. It was quite an interesting moment. I jumped on it and everyone gasped. I had no idea what I'd done until afterwards. But I got the bug. And so I carried on telling and I travelled around and told at these various clubs. And in the background, I was writing. I've always written. I remember at school, I liked writing, but I never finished stories. That was my biggest thing. I started writing, got excited, never finished. I got a few children's stories, a few picture books that I'd worked on, and they were just sat there kind of thing. One day I might get it published. And then teaching came to an end. It had run its course. I had enough with all the extra, you know, wasn't having a weekend. My kids weren't seeing me, that kind of thing. So I jacked all that in. Started working at an events venue for a couple of years, building on experience of working in pubs and restaurants for 10 years. And then moved into the heritage sector. I now, I'm the operations supervisor at the Moira Furnace Museum in the middle of the National Forest. And throughout all of this, I was storytelling and I was writing. And then someone else who you'll know, and a lot of storytelling enthusiasts will know, Dave Tong, a friend of mine, he announced that he was writing this book for History Press. And I thought, ooh, I could do that. These are folk tales for children. I want to write children's stuff. I've written children's stuff and just not got it published. So I hit Dave up for the contacts, and he said, oh, yeah, yeah, I thought about you when they were talking to me. So here's the contacts. Good luck. I fired off three stories to the History Press, one after another, going, I'd love to write this book about Leicestershire folk tales for children, because I live in Leicestershire, born and bred in Leicestershire. I know all these quirky little things, these little folk tales from where I live, as well as the rest of Leicestershire. And after three stories were sent, the History Press came back and said, yeah, we like your style. We'll let you write the book. And so I started writing Leicestershire folk tales for children. And I just found it came really easy. It was just that whole storytelling. I told the story in words the way I would tell the story orally. And that came out, and that was a success. I did a book launch with that, and a couple of illustrators that I work with. And then I started working at Moira Furnace Museum, and I wanted another book out there. And I had the idea, I work in the middle of the National Forest. Why don't I see if they want forest folk tales for children? You know, I'm based in a forest. There was a festival that happens down the road from where I work called the Timber Festival. It was supposed to be its fourth year this year. Unfortunately, with everything that's happened, it didn't happen. But I said to the History Press, I said, I've got contacts at this festival. I can do a book launch at this Timber Festival. It's all about woodlands and forests and nature and that kind of thing. They said, yeah, that's great, we'll go with it. Although there's other people who had the same idea, similar idea, we'll go with you. However, this was October. The festival was the beginning of July the next year. They wanted the final copies by the 1st of January, so I had 2.5 months to write 22,000 words for the book. Needless to say, my family didn't see much of me over Christmas. I was sat on my bed with books piled around me, folktale books, and trying. The hardest part wasn't working out the stories, but working out what forests I was going to include. It's not until you start looking at a map of Britain, you realise how many forests there are. And some forests you didn't even realise were forests. And so that's it, really. It came out last year, and it's been steadily ticking over since then. And every now and then I get a lovely review in, and it's really exciting. And then someone asked me to do this, and, you know, it's fantastic.
Yeah, and it is a lovely book. And I do like the illustrations for this, which are kind of woodcut style, I think, yeah, work really well. Now, you break the book down into themes, don't you? So I've just turned to ghostly beasts, for example, king's curses and colluders, fairies, dragons, and so on. You've got a theme per forest?
Yeah, so what I did is the reference books I use, the one I like the most, the one I keep going back to, it's checking the bibliography, it's Simpson, the Westwood and Simpson, The Law of the Land.
Law of the Land.
I love that book. Yeah, beautiful book. And I always, that's my go-to book. And I started looking through there and a few of the other folktale books that I had. And I noticed that there weren't really many folktales based in forests at first. And I'm thinking, why is that? I think, well, that goes back to the fact that forests are scary and we stayed out of forests and forests, you know, the settlements cropped up around the edge of forests. But you've got the, going back to the well-known stories like Little Red Riding Hood, it's there telling you to stay out of the forest, else the big bad wolf will get you. It's those kind of things. And Hansel and Gretel, the scary forest. So I thought, well, okay, let's get the stories around the edge of the forest because a lot of them happen in the forest. And then I started to find there were themes, natural themes. The first time it twigged was I was looking at Gainsborough and Great Dalby Forest in Yorkshire. And I suddenly realised there were a load of stories about hobs. For those who don't know what a hob is, it's essentially a house elf. J.K. Rowling nicked the idea from that. She took that and renamed them. Little hairy men that live in your house. You don't know they're there. They tidy up. And they get very offended if you try and clothe them because they go around naked. And I thought, oh, there's one here and there's one here and there's one here. And they all cluster around these forests. And then I thought, well, North Wales is dragons. It's got to be dragons. And North Wales is covered in low-lying forests that are actually rainforests because of the amount of rain. And then I noticed there were witches and wizards in around Monmouth and the Forest of Dean there. And so it just kind of it grew from there, really. And I thought, well, that would be a great way to chapter the book, really, having these themes based around these forests.
So how did you generate the style of stories that you use when you're telling for children? Because some stories can be quite dark, some can be quite complex, and it depends on your sources and where you're getting stories from, whether you're collecting them orally, whether they're coming from books like Law of the Land, for example, and other places. And you want a consistent style then for your style of telling. So how did you adapt the stories that you're collecting to form this collection?
I'm a big believer in storytelling, you tell the stories that speak to you. By all means, try a story, and if it doesn't work, it falls flat, that's fine. That's not your story. That's not one for you to tell. And that's fine. So all the stories that I know anyway and that I tell, they tend to be ones that resonate with me, ones that have a bit of humour, a bit of darkness to them. I think it's very important for children to be scared whilst reading stories or listening to stories, because it's a safe space. They can be scared within the story and learn how to cope with being scared. And then when they're scared in real life, they know how to deal with it because they've learned through the story. And then for the style of the stories in my book, it's just a case of finding the story and just playing with it in my head. It's just, it goes round and round in my head, and, you know, how will I tell this? How will I make this relatable for an 8-9-year-old? I'm lucky that I've got a 7-year-old daughter, who's very, literate and very, she was speaking before she was one, you know, my 4-year-old boy's a bit too young, but my daughter, I would try these stories on her. Although she was younger than my target audience, she had the understanding, you know, not to brag or anything, but this morning we'd invented a new game. Instead of badminton, it was bardminton, where we threw William Shakespeare quotes at each other. Brilliant. I was amazed my 7-year-old daughter knew them, but so it just kind of develops from there. And I guess when I get typing, I just kind of get in the zone and boom. Some of the stories in the book are traditional, they're pretty much lifted from the page of where I found them and tweaked and put my own words. This is my own telling. And some of the stories are stories that are very personal to me. So the Robin Hood story, for example. I wanted to tell a story of Robin Hood that wasn't a regular story. People wouldn't have heard. Now, this story I first heard told by Pete Davies, who was I've already mentioned, from Nottingham. Now, he sadly passed away a few years ago. So I tell this story in memory of him. And the story is actually a Jack story with a boggart. But he told it, because he's from Nottingham, as Robin Hood and a giant cyclops. And it just works. It's comedic, it's scary in parts, but the hero wins. It links up a time before Robin Hood was famous to then when he meets his merry men and becomes famous. It kind of works. And although it's not an actual Robin Hood story, I think especially with children, the sources to me don't really matter. It's if it's a good story and it fits and it works, that's all children really want.
Yeah. So you've got a fair few themes that you've told stories on. I'll just run through the ones from the contents page of the book. So you've covered Hobbes, dragons, fairies, king's curses and colluders, ghostly beasts, Robin Hood, as you say, witches and wizards, trees, and the green man. So there's obviously a couple of themes here. There's a kind of a nature theme, obviously. It is forest folktales, after all. And kind of a bit of a supernatural creature theme there with ghostly beasts, hobs, dragons, and so on. Which was your particular favourite to work with?
I always like dragon stories. For a long time, my logo was a dragon. I have a dragon. He's not here. He's flown off somewhere. Dennis, my dragon. So I like those. But although I like the nature stories, I do like the supernatural side of things. I am a skeptic. However, I'm a skeptileaver. I want to believe, although I'm skeptic, you know. The place I managed, Moira Furness, it's 200 plus years old and it was lived in up until the 1970s. And I've done a few paranormal investigations there. And there is definitely something there. You know, I've had a door slam on me and that kind of thing. So I really enjoy those spooky ones. I think my favourite story out of all of them was the beasts in Thetford Forest. I can't remember what I called it now, but you know, I wrote this book 2 years ago now. It's one of those you do interviews and things and you think, oh, I can't remember now. It's been a while since what's it called? The Legend of the Beast of Southery. Again, with Thetford Forest, being quite a new forest, I had to, you know, be a bit fast and loose with the locations, but Southery is right on the edge of Thetford and that kind of thing. But I really like that. It's in the vein of Black Shuck and, you know, the Shag Dog stories of the big black beasts and that phantom beast. And I like that. I like the whole, they go from menacing, horrible, snarling creatures to a protector of the righteous. I quite like that. So that was my favourite.
Excellent. So by way of illustration, I'm going to ask you to tell one of the stories from the book. You don't have to read it. You can tell it in your own style. You are a storyteller, after all. Because I want to use that to talk a little bit afterwards about the way that you follow on from these stories. So I'm going to mute myself for a couple of minutes and just give you an opportunity to tell one of the stories from the book. So away you go.
Thank you. So I'm going to tell this one. It's the Gwaiba of Penmachno, and it's a story from North Wales. I love Wales. Wales is one of my favourite places to be. North Wales is beautiful, rugged, and quite sparse up on the mountaintops. Now, in North Wales, they call dragons gwybers. And this comes from snakes, adders. It's believed that if an adder drinks the milk of a human mother, then it turns into a dragon, a gwyber. And there was one such gwyber, a huge creature it was. It had decided to make its home high on a cliff above a river near Bettisycwyd. And down below, the villagers were worried. You see, the dragon would often fly off and pick out the cattle from the field and feast on the horses and the sheep and maybe burn some of the crops. Nobody wanted to do anything about it because they were too scared. And then a rogue, an outlaw, came to town and saw a chance to redeem himself. Maybe he could become a hero in this part of town. So he decided he was going to go and slay the dragon. But being quick of wit, he decided to go and ask the local wise man, who it was told could foresee your death. And he thought, if I go to the wise man and he tells me the dragon's going to kill me, then I'm not going to go and try and kill this dragon. So he goes to the wise man and he sits down. And he says, oh, wise man, he said, please tell me, how am I going to die? And the wise man, he stroked his long beard, because all wise men have to have long beards. And he said, you are going to die through poisoning. It will course through your veins and stop your heart. And the man left, and he thought to himself, hold on, a gwyber comes from an adder, and adders are poisonous. They've got venom. Maybe there's something in this, he thought. I know, I'll disguise myself and I'll go back again and ask him a second time. And if he still says I'm going to die through venom, then I know I shouldn't do it. And so he disguises himself with a pair of glasses and a fake big nose. And off he goes back into the old man's hut. And he asked the old man how he's going to die. And the old man once again stroked his beard. And he said, you are going to die through a broken neck. It'll be shattered in many places. And so the man left and he took off his fake glasses and his nose. And he thought, what a crock of rubbish. This old man doesn't know what he's talking about. I'll try one more time just to be sure that he's talking rubbish. And so this time he dresses in a dress, long hair and bosoms, and off he goes and he sits there and he says, wise man, how am I going to die, please? And the wise man stroked his beard and he said, you are going to drown. The water will fill your lungs and push the air out, and you will rest at the bottom of the water. And so the man left and he derobed and he thought, what a load of rubbish. I'm safe. I'm not going to get killed by a dragon. And so he took his sword, his trusty sword, and he went to attack the dragon. Now, he didn't go the normal route to the top of the cliff. He decided to climb up the cliff, straight up. Now, the gwyber surely wouldn't expect this, he thought. But as he mantled the top of the cliff, he hauled himself up to see the dragon face to face with him, waiting for him. The dragon, the gwyber, as quick as a snake, for that's what it once was, bit the man on his shoulder, and he felt the venom start to pulse through his veins. Oh, he cried, and he let go of the cliff. And he tumbled down and backwards and round through the air until his head met a rock and he snapped his neck clean in two. But just before the life left him, his body hit the river below. And there in the water, his lungs began to fill with liquid and the air left his body. And poisoned, with a broken neck, he drowned. And so ends my story. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Tom. And what I like about the stories, excuse me, what I like about the stories in this book is that they are followed by a couple of other things. So after each story, you have a little bit that says, did you know? And then you have a bit on the other side that says, why don't you? So one of these is what, some extra facts about the area in which you set the story and those sorts of things. Is that right?
Yes, it's just little interesting tidbits and that kind of stuff. So talking with the history press, they said, oh, we want a bit of a different feel to these books going forward. They're going to be hardback rather than paperback. We're going to use in-house illustrators. We're going to source the illustrators rather than you sourcing them. And we want them to be a bit more interactive. And can you use your teacher background to do this? How about some facts and things? So I thought, ideal, that I can do that. And so, yeah, the did you know is something based around the area. So, like I said, the Snowdonian forests actually being rainforests. So something I didn't know, interesting fact. And then the why don't you, again, that comes from being a teacher and from having kids of my own. And I want them to be inspired by the stories and go out into the forest and try these things. So the one, again, from in Wales, it's why don't you go and fight a log dragon with a stick? I'm always careful as well to put little caveats and, you know, don't fight each other and don't poke each other in the eye, that kind of thing.
Yes.
But, you know, try and get them to get out there and play in nature and just enjoy being in those forests.
Yes, that's it. It's exploring the environment, isn't it? It's encouraging, learning through play is a very important thing. And then you have things like, yes, try to fight it with your friends using sticks as swords. Remember, though, you need to work together to overcome this foul beast, not hit each other with your swords. Teamwork is key. So, yes, it's teaching little lessons as well. I guess this is your teacher background kind of sneaking through, isn't it? But I think that's brilliant. Because folk tales are little kind of nuggets of education, after all. You know, they are used so many times to teach lessons. And that's a good way of enhancing and establishing those lessons and things, isn't it? It's just by giving some extra activities that people can try.
There's a wonderful animation narrated by Sir Ian McKellen that I absolutely love. I don't know if you've seen it. It's about the importance of stories and storytelling. And it tells of how the first storytellers came to be, and it was cavemen, and they go out and they fight this saber-toothed cat, and one of them gets killed and the other one manages to kill the saber-toothed cat, and they go back and they tell this story, and that story becomes ingrained in tradition and folklore of that tribe, and they spread it around. And but the key to that story is, be careful out there, the world is big and dangerous. And it shows how we learn, as you say, from stories, from folk tales, and that's why they last, and that's the enduring nature of folk tales. We pass these on to our children, and they learn from them, and hopefully learn important, valuable lessons that will keep them safe going forward. And even as adults, you know, we read them and go, oh yeah, that's a metaphor for this, or the, yes. You know,
yeah,
yeah, okay, and we relate to them in that way.
Excellent. So what's next? Are you tempted to write for the adult market, or are you sticking with children's writing?
Stick with kids. So what's next? I need to... I'm playing with an idea at the moment, speaking with another friend of mine, Kat Weatherall, maybe familiar with her work. She's a fantastic author, a good friend. And she's suggested I do something along the lines of folk tales that dads can tell to their kids. Mm. We've had a lot of books about females, heroines and goddesses, and we've got most of those, and me and my daughter read most of things, you know, the bedtime stories of rebel girls and that kind of stuff, and Xanthi Gresham's Goddesses and Heroines, that's a great book, if you want to check that out. But yeah, so I'm playing with that idea. But I've also, for how many years now? Well over a decade, if not 15 years or so, been trying to write a novel, the first of three. I've got a whole trilogy planned out in my head, and I've spoken to many people about it. I've got the first 12, 13 chapters written, which I want to go back and rewrite. And the idea is to finally one day get that finished, try and get that published, a proper book aimed at the 9 to 12 year old market, and carry on. And I'd also like to one day, again, these are all one day, I'd like to get some of my shorter stories, some of my picture books published, but just hoping that books like these help me, if I go to publishers, be able to say, I've done that. There's an example of what I've written.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That's a great thing too, to be able to do that. And a good selection to be working on there as well, isn't it? I wish you every success with all of those. They'd be absolutely Thank wonderful. You must have had a chance, because this has been out for a little while, to do some live events using this book before we went into the kind of not live event scenario that we're in at the moment. How did that go? How was it received? How does it work with an audience of kids in front of you?
Yeah, so I've done a few. I always juggle work with storytelling, so I'm not a full-time storyteller. I can never quite make the bills, pay the bills with my storytelling, especially with the wife and kids. So I've always worked. So the events have been sporadic, but when they have happened, it's been in schools and that kind of things. And it's worked really well. What I tend to do is maybe tell one or two stories from here and then tell other stories that are similar, of a similar nature, that have nature links and that kind of thing, or might have a dragon in and say, well, you know, I've got a whole chapter on dragons, that kind of thing. So the kids really, really engage, and I've got quite an engaging way of telling to kids. I just kind of get a child audience. You know, I know some people say, oh, children, oh, a child audience scares me. For me, 100 kids in front of me, I'm happy. Give me a room of adults, that's when the nerves creep in. That's when I get worried, because I'm sitting there thinking, are they judging me? What's going on? At least with kids, if they get bored, you know, because they're sat there picking their nose, looking at the ceiling, you know, it's really obvious. So yeah, it's gone down well. And yeah, hopefully when things start to return to normal, I can get out and do a bit more storytelling and promote the book a bit more.
Let's hope so. In the meantime, if people want to have a look at your work and other bits and pieces, have you got an online presence that they should be looking at?
Yes, it's mainly Facebook. I was paying for a website for a bit, but it's one of those, it barely ever got looked at, and I thought, well, I'm not bothering paying for that. The majority of my work comes through Facebook. So if you want to check me out, I'm on Facebook as Tom the Tale Teller. So that's my storytelling alias, Tom the Tale Teller. And you can find everything on there, really. I am on Twitter at Tale Teller Tom, and on Instagram, but they barely ever get updated. I'm more of a Facebook man myself, but it's all there.
Excellent. So I will put links to those in the description below this video so that people can pop off and have a look at those. If you are interested in getting hold of a copy of Forest Folk Tales for Children by Tom Phillips, then you can get that from the History Press. You can get it from all good bookshops, probably quite a few bad ones as well, and from the normal online retailers that deal with these sorts of things. Support your independent bookshops, or the publisher directly if you are able to do so, will always be my advice in these matters. Tom?
Or they could always buy direct from me, get a signed copy, and it helps me out more because of the deal with the History Press. I get more for the book. So, you know, I can feed my children that way.
Look at that. As you can't go wrong with that, can you? And you can have a signed copy as well. And I'm sure if somebody messages you on Facebook, you'll probably write a little dedication in the front for them too.
Yes, I love doing that. I feel famous. It's great. And I'm not, but I feel it.
Perfect. However you want to get hold of a copy, I recommend that you do so. Tom, thank you so much for taking the time to come on and talk about your work on the Folklore Podcast book.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Tom. If you want to look at his work in more detail, then do follow the links which he referred to in the interview, which are posted down in the description below. You can also follow those to buy yourself a copy of the book if you want to do so. The Folklore Podcast Book Club and the Folklore Podcast are both offered completely free of charge. If you'd like to help us to continue to make this content, do please follow the links in the description below, where you'll be able to visit our Patreon page and support us for extra rewards and bonus content, or make a one-off donation via our website. If you can't do either of those things and still want to help, then do please share our programming, share our main podcast and the items that you'll find on our YouTube channel. And do please, while you're here, subscribe to the channel to get notifications when we put up more videos. Thanks very much for watching, and I'll see you again on the next episode of the Folklore Podcast Book Club. Bye for now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.